New York City Opera kicks off its new season with La Traviata. The Brooklyn Academy of Music began yesterday and runs through the 18th. The production of Verdi's masterpiece is the season's first New York City Opera staging at BAM, and it'll be followed by the U.S. premiere performance of Rufus Wainwright's Prima Donna from February 19th through the 25th. Joining us now to discuss the past and the future of the company is New York City Opera's general manager and artistic director, George Steele. Welcome back to our show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, when you last visited the show in late November 2009, you were just about to open your season at the newly refurbished and recently renamed David H. Koch Theater in Lincoln Center, and you're opening this new season at BAM. Has the Koch Theater not worked out?
The Koch Theater sounds terrific, but for New York City Opera has moved out of it. It was our home for about 50 years, and prior to that we were at New York City Center. But this season we've started a new life performing in theaters around New York, and we've opened this new chapter with BAM, which is actually perfect for us. One of the great liberties of not being tied to Lincoln Center is that we can find theaters that best support the work we're doing. And there is only one functioning 19th century style opera house in all of New York City. It's the Gilman Opera House at BAM. It is the ideal place, bar none, to hear La Traviata.
Well, you didn't answer my question, but I won't pursue it any further. The question is, what happened at the David Koch?
Oh, well, as I think many of your listeners will know, the company has recently, we've just successfully completed a complete financial transformation of New York City Opera, and I think one that has put us much closer to pursuing our artistic mission than we were before. And the three big things that we did were to streamline the full-time staff, to move out of Lincoln Center.
Which was expensive?
Extremely expensive. And finally, to renegotiate two of our most important labor contracts.
And so here you are going to BAM. You're also going to be in the Upper West Side, East Harlem and Central Park. I'd imagine that that presents its own kinds of complications because you have to adjust to each of the new venues.
Well, you know, there are logistical challenges to moving among venues. But in fact, we're going to places that are, with one exception, extremely well-established places for performance. BAM, you know, has been around for 150 years. Caruso sang there. The Metropolitan Opera used to tour there. Though incredibly, La Traviata, which we opened yesterday to a sold-out house, hasn't been performed there since the mid-60s. So here's one of the great spaces in New York City without some of the greatest repertoire there is. BAM does an incredible job at, for instance, baroque music, at very progressive music, dance, theater, the rest of it. But the one thing that we're happy to bring there is, of course, 19th century opera.
When the New York City Opera was founded almost 70 years ago, Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia dubbed it the People's Opera. Is the People's Opera still a fitting description of New
I think
City
more
opera?
Than ever. In this new chapter in our life, I think we are closer to LaGuardia's original mission than ever. Not only artistically, that we can support the work, frankly, better. La Traviata sounds better, looks better, and feels better at BAM than it did at our old theater. But also we are out seeing the people of New York in the neighborhoods of New York, thanks to very generous underwriting from the Peter J. Sharp Foundation and from the Reed Foundation. All of the remaining tickets for our BAM season, I'm sorry, that number is now zero remaining tickets, but there are a handful of tickets to Traviata, and there are some tickets available to Rufus's opera, but I'm sure that both will be sold out. But people should call BAM's box office straight away to get tickets. But
well, I'm sure people have seen the ads for Rufus's opera all over town.
Absolutely. And the tickets, those that remain, are $25, thanks to this underwriting. So the People's Opera is absolutely who we are.
Do you also feel liberated from being across the courtyard from the Metropolitan Opera? Because people constantly compare whether that's fair or not.
Well, I don't know about fair, but I think some geographical distance really highlights our unique mission. I mean, we are New York City Opera. We are a part of the fabric of New York. And by performing at BAM and in Central Park and at the Museo del Barrio, people get a very clear sense of who we are and that our connection to the city is central to our identity.
Now, it is rare for a city, even a city as large as New York, to have more than one opera company. We used to have the Amato as well. But are there any other places in Europe, in Vienna?
Tons and tons and tons of cities around Europe have more than one major opera company. And frankly, that's one of the marks of New York as a great international city, is the fact that we have these two giant opera companies. And even New York City Opera, by the way, even with a slightly reduced season this year, or a genuinely reduced season, we're still one of the leading companies in the country and in the world.
You say that there are two kinds of opera campaign, the big ones with big contracts and all the others. Now, when you talk about the big ones, you talk about what New York City Opera used to be?
Well, I think I was talking about there are two kinds of opera contracts. And the it sounds like an old soundbite from our labor negotiations, but there were four companies in the country that had really giant guarantees built into their contracts with orchestra and chorus. Those are the Met, US, San Francisco, and Chicago. And that those guarantees really don't fit the way we do business now, and we could not have continued under those terms.
Well, is the New York City Opera the Oakland A's of the opera world, having to compete in a major market on a limited budget?
Well, I don't think so. Look, New York has the
Brad
Mets
Pitt
and the
would
Yankees.
Be really good playing you.
We've got the Jets and the Giants. We've got the Mets and the Yankees. We've got MoMA and the Metropolitan Museum. I mean, it's a city of great dualities. And I think the interplay between New York City Opera and the Metropolitan Opera has been an incredibly fruitful one for both companies. The number of great singers who sing at the Met now and have in the past who got their start with us is an enormous list, with Placido Domingo and Beverly Sills and Joyce DiDonato and the rest of them. The number of Metropolitan Opera board members who started at New York City Opera is a long one. And the number of works that we premiered that the Met wouldn't touch with a 27-foot pole is incredibly long. Works, the major American works, major European works, Moses und Aaron and Lulu and the rest of it. So New York City Opera plays a vital role, not only to the city, but for global opera.
The Met has started to loosen up a bit and now has included some of those kinds of operas in its repertoire. I suspect because people were impressed by the productions that you were doing of them.
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, the Metropolitan Opera has learned many, many things from the way New York City Opera has done business over the years, and I'm sure that they will continue to. We are about the future of opera. We have been since we were founded. Who are the new singers? What is the new repertoire? Who are the new directors? Who, and most importantly, perhaps, who are the new audiences for this form? The New York City Opera has been dedicated to figuring that out since we were founded.
And how did you come to do Rufus Wainwright's Prima Donna?
Well, Rufus has been a fan of opera for a long time, and he's been a friend of New York City Opera for a very long time. And he came to see me, I guess, not long after the Metropolitan Opera decided not to produce it. Maybe you know this story, but it's sort of bizarre to me that the Met and Rufus parted ways. The Met had commissioned the piece because Rufus wanted to do it in French.
They do a lot of operas in French.
That's my impression.
I think I saw Carmen there in French.
I think they do plenty of shows in French. And after all, this is maybe the most polyglot city in the world. I think we can say that definitively. So to do an opera in French, of all things, when there's a massive Francophone population, makes total sense to me. So I went to see the opera in its premiere. And I was suspicious, frankly. You know, one never knows. New opera is always a risk. And I knew Rufus as a composer of very small forms, and opera is a very, very big form. But I was really blown away by how effectively he handled the giant operatic forces, the scale of the piece, and finally of just the sheer beauty of some of the arias.
My guest is George Steele, General Manager and Artistic Director of the New York City Opera. When you came to our show 3 years ago, we talked about the New York City Opera being in crisis when you signed on as its new general manager and artistic director. There were financial problems and wrangling with its employee unions. Also, at that time, performances had been suspended while the New York State Theater was being refurbished, now the David H. Koch Theater. And then we started hearing this year about more labor issues that you had to deal with before the beginning of this season. So is this a continuation of the problem that you had to deal with when you first took over?
Well, they're very much related. I would say when I took over, you know, the company was at a pretty low point, and it had a turnaround plan in place that they'd put in place before I came, and it just was not tenable. It was not based on reality, and unfortunately, it was just based on raising much more money than the company could ever raise. It was basically predicated on a 50% increase in fundraising overnight coming out of a dark season.
Sounds like your whole board was in Washington, D.C.
No. I think the board, bless them, had struggled mightily. You know, the company has not had a balanced budget in over a decade, and I'm happy to say, with the recent difficult but successful eventually negotiations over our contracts, we have completed the final piece of our total financial rebuilding, and we are on track to have the first balanced budget in over a decade.
Well, how much of this is just the fact that young people are less interested in opera than previous generations?
Well, I don't think that's true, actually, and it's amazing the number of people who use the word opera and operatic to talk about their work. Like Karen O did a song cycle out at St. Anne's, and she talked about making an opera. You have Lady Gaga, who is maybe the most operatic pop star we've ever had. I think, frankly, the idea of taking all the arts and bringing them together to make some new thing is at the epicenter of the cultural imagination. The problem is that opera as a racket is off in the corner, and it's my job to push opera back to the center of the culture, to involve people from all walks, all artistic walks of life, and to make opera something that is vital to the culture, that everybody feels like they have an opinion about, everybody feels they can participate in. And I think, frankly, that's another part of being the people's opera, is making opera something that people own.
And I did read a Met study that found the age of the average Met audience member, including single sale customers and subscribers, went from 60.4 years of age in 2005 to 57.7 in 2011.
Eureka.
It's not exactly 21-year-olds, but still it does suggest that younger people are starting to go to opera.
Well, let's be candid. The price point for opera is astronomical, and particularly at Lincoln Center, the tickets tend to be very expensive. So the initiative that we had to make all of our remaining tickets $25 paid off in spades. And yesterday, as I say, was the opening performance with the wonderful Laquita Mitchell in La Traviata. And the place was absolutely sold out. There was a standby line, and there were many people in their 20s and 30s there.
Now, New York Magazine wrote that if the Metropolitan Opera is opera's global brand, City Opera is the local high-risk alternative. Do you see it that way?
Well, it's an interesting reading. I mean, we certainly take more artistic risks than the Metropolitan Opera, and I think because we're able to. I love the Met, but they're, architecture is destiny in some ways, and we've just freed ourselves from that ball and chain. But I would say that New York City Opera has a global mission and global reach. For instance, the resurgence in the staging of Handel's operas is something that was led by New York City Opera. And that is true, frankly, of the revival of bel canto operas, that thanks to Beverly Seals' pioneering performances of Donizetti, that repertoire really came back to life.
They had been relatively ignored for a while because they weren't drawing audiences. You had to find a way to recast them?
I think because operatic repertoire tends to be discarded at a relatively high rate, even the greatest works. And the so-called canon of works tends to be very, very small. And it's only in the advent of the 20th century and the mid-20th century that, things got – the reach of operatic repertoire got broader and broader and broader.
The Met, less you, but you do rely also on the old war horses. The Met just seemed to only be putting on the fan favorites, the greatest hits.
Peter and I have talked, Peter Gelb and I have talked about
it. Well, he's changed that.
Well, exactly. That it turns out that the obvious favorites are not favorites that long. And, people who subscribe have seen the production of Tosca and would like to see something else, thank you very much. And so it's not that Tosca is not worthy, but to do the same production of Tosca for 20 years courts fan ennui.
My guest is George Steele, General Manager and Artistic Director of the New York City Opera, which is beginning its current season at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in the Great Opera House there, or as opposed to the Harvey, which
That's
is
true, yes.
Down the block, which also, by the way, might really be a great venue
for nice
opera because it's a beautiful space.
It is a beautiful space. I think there, smaller scale works. Traviata is a big opera with a big orchestra, and I don't think, frankly, it would fit at the Harvey.
But did you have to bring in all the sets and everything?
Absolutely everything. And I should point out something. We talked about, bringing back war horses. One of the things we notice is that our fans love new productions. They want to see something they haven't seen. And we ask the audiences, both subscribers and single ticket buyers, what makes you go to the opera? And their response was to see something I've never seen before. So this season, all four of the operas that we're doing on our main season this spring are new productions. They've never been seen in New York, and that is something I think that we can deliver, is the sense of wow and now, that everybody's sort of seeing a show for the first time. I think it will engage new audiences and repeat customers.
Well, what can you tell us about some of the other productions that are coming up later this season? We have Mozart's Così fan tutti opening in March at John Jay College, a nice theater there, and a production of Telemann's Orpheus. When was the last time Orpheus was produce in this city? That's going to be at the Museo del Barrio.
Yeah. Well, those are two incredibly special shows in relatively modest-sized houses, which means they will without question sell out. Così fan tutte, I will predict, might be one of the most talked-about productions of the season. Christopher Alden is directing, and he directed our Don Giovanni when you and I spoke. Mm-hmm. It was the first show I did at when I came to the opera. But it was one of the best productions. I think the Times called it the best production of the season. An amazing cast. And, you know, here's something. This is a kind of repertoire that New York City Opera can do better, I think, than the Metropolitan Opera. Shows that rely on ensemble acting. I mean, we have the entire cast together for 5 or 6 weeks building these pieces. It builds a kind of theater that can't be got any other way. We're doing it in a house much closer to the house size that Mozart had in mind. You know, you can stretch these pieces and do them in 2, 3, 4, 5,000 seat houses, but you lose something in the translation.
Because they were really meant as something more intimate.
Well, the theaters were smaller in those days. So to hear Cosi in a 600 seat house is an incredible privilege. And with a cast that's just spectacular. Sergei Kubiak, who made a great hit in Bernstein's A Quiet Place, Phil Cutlip, Alan Clayton, wonderful British tenor. It's just going to be Jennifer Holloway and Marie Lenormand. I mean, it will be a fabulous production and very, very much talked about. Christopher Alden is one of the most brilliant opera directors of our time.
I want to get back to the labor issues because traditionally opera companies, symphony orchestras, they keep the musicians on staff, not the singers, but they keep the musicians on staff throughout the year, don't they?
I think I know where you're headed, but... I'll head you off at the pass and say
that... You've said that in order to survive, the City Opera must transition to the model that most opera companies use, paying people only for the work that they do.
Correct.
Well, we had a different system here than you would have had in the Paris Opera or
York City Opera, as I said earlier, there were four companies in the country that had big guarantee contracts. All the rest of the opera companies in the country pay only for the work that happens. That's true of Washington National Opera, Houston Grand Opera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So in New York, we had a different model?
The New York City Opera had a big guarantee-based contract just like the Metropolitan Opera. And that was the problem. Our contracts were structured as though we were the Met, and we're not the Met.
For the musicians, of course, they say, well, we are committing ourselves to your season whenever it is, and that means that we can't commit ourselves to other groups, to other places.
There's no sugarcoating the fact that under the new contract, many of our musicians, maybe most of them, will make less money than they made under the old system. That is a difficult reality, and it's frankly one that people all over the country are facing. But I think what the musicians decided, and it's up for them to speak to it, but is that preserving the company and keeping the work going was more important even than that principle. And frankly, now we can grow. All the money that we're spending goes on the stage, and rather than paying for people not working, we're able to pay people to work, and the most important thing that we're focusing on now is growth. I think the right size for the company is 8 to 10 productions a season. I think we will grow very, very soon, and we'll get to that beautiful size. And by the way, at 8 to 10 productions a season, we will be the United States' second largest opera company once again.
Wow. But you also had to restructure the non-artistic side.
Well, that was what the whole last two seasons have been about, is about looking at the financial structure of the company and finding a sustainable way. The company had all kinds of its own internal issues. There were external economic issues and cultural issues, as you hint. But the company can be a success, and we have demonstrated that it can now have financial stability, and that's the only way it can grow.
Well, before you took on this job, you were the executive director of the Miller Theater at Columbia University.
That's right.
A lot more modest situation. Did you know what you were getting yourself into when you took this job?
Well, I had in some ways I knew exactly what I was getting into, and in other ways there were many, many surprises. But ultimately, the job has not changed, and frankly, my mission has not changed since when you and I spoke 2 years ago. It is to stabilize the finances of the company so that it will grow. And I'm thrilled to say we've just done it. I mean, the day that some thought would never come, but I knew always in my heart would come, that we opened our season at BAM with a spectacular production. And as I say, it's sold out. There are a handful of tickets left. But that's what we're about. We now are on track to finish the year in a stable position with a balanced budget, and we can grow.
In other countries, aren't the opera companies generally subsidized by the government?
Well, yes, this is the envious American looking at Europe, but it varies from country to country. But yes, there are giant government subsidies. I think perhaps the Paris Opera has the highest. The German opera houses do pretty well. The English ones less so, but there's still generous subsidies relative to the U.S. And that's enviable in one sense. In another sense, there is something extraordinary about this crazy American system, that we're very responsive to the marketplace, that it requires constant rethinking of our mission, and it means doing something that matters. That's the issue. You must do something. If you're a mission-driven organization and most of your income is contributed, or anywhere from half to, in our case, maybe 75% of the income is contributed, mission matters. Making opera available to everybody, regardless of ticket price, matters. Doing work that is about the future of the company, of the art, matters, and championing the careers of young American singers matters.
But it also means that you're spending an awful lot of your time fundraising, doesn't it?
Without a doubt, but that such is my lot in life. But that's not
a lot of rubber chicken as a result.
No, not too much rubber chicken. And I'll say something about fundraising. When you are doing something that people get right away, when you sit down with somebody and explain what the company is about, and they understand it, fundraising is not hard. The key is to make sure that people are giving money to something that has a sound business model and a sound artistic, even visionary artistic idea. That is an invitation to donors, and there are a lot of wonderful people in this city who believe very, very deeply in the art and very, very deeply in access to the arts and, frankly, very deeply in the beauty of New York City.
Does it matter where the money comes from? For many years, people were concerned that Philip Morris, a cigarette company, was a major donor to the arts. You were in the David H. Koch Theater. The Koch brothers are rather controversial politically. Some people have told me they don't want to go to that theater simply because it has that name on it.
Well, I would say, the arts are funded by everybody, a cross-section. And the Kochs, for all of the meanness that they've been exposed to in the press, they have different political views than perhaps you do, but they're not lawbreakers. They're just pursuing their agenda. So I think, frankly, David's giving $100 million to renovate that theater for the public good was not linked remotely to his political ideas. It was linked to just that philanthropy. So I think real philanthropy, regardless of whom it comes from, if the spirit is of giving and of openness, I think it's wonderful.
So is this the way?
And frankly, if we were to discourage people from giving money whom we disagree with politically, we would have a mighty poor culture.
Well,
you think of the Vanderbilts and the Carnegies and there's a long, long list of people who made this city look beautiful, sound beautiful, with whom we might differ politically.
Although a lot of people are pleased that Philip Morris is no longer, I guess they've been pushed out, haven't they?
I don't know about pushed out. Altria, I guess Philip Morris, the U.S. has moved down to Virginia and they don't really give in New York, but, the arts are all the poor. Philip Morris did amazing, amazing work for the arts in New York, the visual arts, dance particularly.
Well, what's happening with the New York City Opera in the future? Are your upcoming seasons going to be similar to this one, BAM, and then Museo de Barrio?
Well, we'll have some good announcements. You are persuasive, but you can't tease out of me too much about next season except to say I'm looking forward to growth in the very short term for the company. We expect to announce in just a few months what we're doing next season. It's a very exciting season, I think right down the fairway of what New York City Opera is about. Just like this season, we have two freshly reimagined classics, a New York premiere, in fact, a U.S. stage premiere at Rufus Wainwright's opera, which opens on the 19th, and finally a rediscovery of a fantastic Baroque masterpiece. We didn't get to talk about Telemann's Orpheus, but Telemann, is a composer people don't think of as an opera composer. He has about 9 operas that survive. He wrote many, many more. And he wrote them for the Hamburg Opera House. Orpheus is maybe his masterpiece. And this theater we're doing it in is the ideal place to hear Baroque opera. It was built as a children's theater. The museo was an orphanage when it was built. This was called the Heckscher Theater. And it's painted with these gorgeous murals by Vili Pogani, a Hungarian book illustrator. It's the ideal place to hear an incredibly gorgeous score.
And you also give people all over town an opportunity to see opera. They don't all have to just go downtown.
Amen. We're the people's opera. Some of the people live in Brooklyn. Some of the people live in Harlem. And it's our job to bring the opera to them.
We have a link to the New York City Opera website for information about tickets and its upcoming schedule. My great thanks to George Steele, General Manager and Artistic Director of the New York City Opera, for being with us today.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.